if that's what she wants. But she might be depressed. She might change her mind. We discussed this for a while. I pointed out that his comments applied well enough to younger people who had many years of life ahead of them if they didn't commit suicide, but I was uncertain if it applied to somebody aged 96 who had little chance of getting home again. I asked Anthony what he thought were the chances of her returning to an independent life in her own home if we operated. "Not very good at her age," he replied, "though I suppose she might get back for a while, but she'll still end up in a nursing home sooner or later if the aortic stenosis doesn't finish her off first." "So what should we do?" I said to the room. There was an uncomfortable silence. I waited for a while. "The only next of kin is a niece. She's coming in this morning," Anthony told us. "Well, any decisions will have to wait until then." My radiological colleague leant over towards me and spoke quietly. "I always find these cases by far the most interesting," he said. "The young ones," he nodded towards the row of junior doctors, "all want to operate and want big, exciting cases. That's fair enough at their age, but the discussions about these everyday cases are fascinating." "Well, I was just like that once upon a time," I replied. "What do you think will happen to her?" he asked. "I don't know. She's not my case." I turned to the assembled doctors. "There's 10 minutes left," I said. "Shall we look at one of the cases on my list for today?" I gave the patient's name to Anthony, and he summoned up a brain scan onto the wall with greater success than with the first case. The scan showed a huge tumour, a benign meningioma, pressing on the left side of the patient's brain. "She's 85 years old," I began. "When I went into neurosurgery 32 years ago, when you lot were probably still in trainer pants, we just didn't operate on people this old. Anybody over the age of 70 was simply considered too old. Now there doesn't seem to be any age limit." So I gave them the history, the story about the patient. I had first seen Mrs. Seagrave several weeks earlier in the outpatient clinic. She was the highly articulate widow of an eminent doctor, and she came accompanied by her three very professional and equally articulate middle-aged children, two daughters and a son. I had to go to another room to bring in some extra chairs. The patient, a short and dominating woman with long grey hair, well turned out and looking younger than her age, marched into the room in an authoritative way. She sat in the chair beside my desk, and her three children sat in a row facing me, a polite but determined chorus. As with most people with problems affecting the front of the brain, she had little insight, if any, into her difficulties. Having introduced myself, I asked her, with the wary sympathy of the doctor anxious to help, but anxious also to avoid the emotional demands patients make of their doctors, to tell me about the problems that had led to her having a brain scan. "I'm perfectly all right," she declared in a ringing tone. "My husband was the professor of gynaecology at St. Anne's. Did you know him?" I said that I did not, that he had been rather before my time. "But it's just outrageous that they," she gestured towards her children sitting opposite her, "won't let me drive. I really can't manage without a car. It's all so sexist. If I was a man, they'd let me drive." "But you are 85 years old," I said. "That has nothing to do with it." "And there is the matter of the brain tumour," I added, pointing to the monitor on my desk. "Have you seen your brain scan before?" "No," she said. "Well, isn't that interesting?" She looked thoughtfully at the scan for a while, showing the large mass, the size of a grapefruit, compressing her brain. "But I really must be allowed to drive. I can't manage without it." "If you'll excuse me," I said, "I would like to ask your children a few questions." I asked about the difficulties their mother had had in recent months. I think they were a little reticent about drawing attention to her problems in her presence, and she constantly interrupted, disputing what they said, and above all, complaining about the fact they would not let her drive. Between the three of them, they gave me to understand that their mother had become confused and forgetful. At first, naturally enough, they had attributed this to her age, but her memory became steadily worse, and she was seen by a geriatrician who had arranged a brain scan. Brain tumours like hers are a rare but recognised cause of dementia, and can be surprisingly large by the time they start to cause problems. It was always possible, however, that she was suffering from Alzheimer's disease as well as having a brain tumour, and an operation to remove the tumour, I therefore told them, was not guaranteed to make her better. It also came with a very real danger of making her much worse. The only sure way of knowing whether the tumour was responsible for her problems, however, would be by removing it. The problem, I told them, was that it was impossible to predict from the scan just how great the risk was of making her worse. It is a question of how stuck the surface of the tumour is to the surface of the brain. And until you operate, you cannot tell how easy or difficult it will be to separate the tumour away from the underlying brain. If it is stuck, the brain will be damaged, and she could be left paralysed down the right side of her body and unable to communicate, as each half of the brain controls the opposite side of the body and the function of speech is on the left side of the brain. "Can't you just remove part of the tumour?" one of the daughters asked, "and leave the part stuck to the brain?" I explained that this rarely worked since these tumours are often quite solid, and if you leave a rigid shell of tumour behind, the brain remains compressed and the patient doesn't get any better, and the tumour can grow back again. "Well, how often is the tumour stuck to the brain?" the other daughter asked. "Well, it's a bit of a guess, but I suppose 20%. So there's a 1 in 5 chance of making her worse. In fact, it was probably slightly more than that, because every time you open somebody's head, there's a 1 to 2% risk of catastrophic hemorrhage or infection. And that risk is probably slightly greater in somebody her age. The only certainty was that she would slowly get worse if we did nothing. But," I added hesitantly, hoping that Mrs. Seagrave herself would not notice, "one might argue that given her age, it was best simply not to operate and accept that she would slowly deteriorate before she died." One of the daughters asked if any treatment other than surgery might help, with Mrs. Seagrave continuing to interrupt, complaining about the monstrous injustice of her not being allowed to drive. I explained that radiotherapy and chemotherapy were of no use with tumours of this type. It was fairly obvious that their mother was not capable of following the conversation. "What would you do if it were your mother?" the son asked. I hesitated before I answered, because I was not sure of the answer. It is, of course, the question that all patients should ask their doctors, but one most are reluctant to ask, since the question suggests that doctors might choose differently for themselves compared to what they recommend for their patients. I replied slowly that I would try to persuade her to have the operation if we, and I gestured to the four of them as I spoke, all felt she was losing her independence and heading for some kind of institutional care. But I said that it was very difficult, that it was all about uncertainty and luck. I was sitting with my back to the window with the three children in front of me as I spoke, and wondered if they could see through the window behind me the large municipal cemetery in the distance beyond the hospital car park. I concluded the meeting by telling them that there was no need to make an immediate decision. I gave them my secretary's phone number and suggested they let me know what they wanted to do in due course. They trooped out, and I removed the three chairs and then went to collect the next patient from the waiting area. I heard a few days later from my secretary, Gail, that they had decided, how much persuasion the patient herself had required, I do not know, that I should operate. She was admitted to the hospital for the operation 3 weeks after the outpatient appointment. The evening before the operation, however, the anaesthetist, a rather young and inexperienced one, had requested a test called an echocardiogram. She might, the anaesthetist said, have a problem with her heart because of her age, although she had no symptoms of heart disease. This test